Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross. With the economy coming back, people who are trying to replace a lost job are hitting the bricks, and they're wondering if there's going to be anything out there for them. And Ranji Sinha from Cairo 7 has been looking into this, and the answer is a resounding yes. There are jobs available, and even if you don't think you're trained for that job, it's time to get out there.
Well, one of the places we actually started with was WorkSource. It's a group that actually helps people transition to new careers, and they gave us a little bit of a roadmap as to where these jobs are. But what we found is, you know, some of the things might be expected. Healthcare clearly is an area which is trying to find people and hiring, but also an information technology. I mean, IT, web development, things of that nature. They're definitely looking for more people for hiring, and even hiring still in sort of the remote work sector. But construction was also a strong area. And when we talk about construction, I'm not necessarily saying just the largest projects either. We're hearing a lot about home building and smaller scale construction projects that need people. So there are three areas that clearly have a drive to hire people right now. And they're looking for people. And we wanted to make sure people knew about that.
One of the things that we've learned from past recessions is that many times the new jobs that become available have nothing to do with the skills of the people who need the work. So, for example, we're coming off a time now where lots of restaurants have closed, and you have people who were working as waiters or in the back kitchen looking for work. If you have to be retrained, is there, and you can't afford it, obviously, because you've been out of work for so long, are there programs to help you out? And can you actually go from being a sous chef or something into software development, which we know has plenty of jobs?
Well, I mean, we talked to one woman and we got a great example. She worked at a call center and the call center was shutting down and those jobs were not going to come back. And she kind of saw the handwriting on the wall. So she did go back to a school and was able to secure help. Sometimes WorkSource will connect you with people. They said that they're willing to try to, you know, find support structures for people who want to transition. I was actually a little surprised. I mean, they said, like, we can help you with childcare. We can help you with, you know, certain levels of expenses or even finding scholarships. So there are things out there. It's just for people to look into them. And then, you know, I also was impressed that the woman in the call center, like, she went into a program and then even before the program had finished, she was already getting inquiries about being hired.
Really?
She was in her last week. She was still doing finals and trying to pass the exams to finish the course and was also telling them, hey, I've got interviews. Can I go? And they're like, yeah, go, please. We'll work around this. Let's get this done. And so there are support structures out there. And I was kind of surprised at the extent people were willing to go. I think a lot of these groups that are trying to help people transition, they recognize that people have been, you know, out of work or coming from fields where, you know, they don't have the experience in the areas that are hiring. So they're trying to, you know, get people acclimated to a new career as quickly as possible. It's interesting that you mentioned the recession. We went to the Carpentry Apprentice Program for King and Pierce County. And the woman who runs it, she said she's looking for people right now. She wants them. But she said one interesting thing that I really took to heart. She said in 2008, when the Great Recession, quote unquote, hit, they really scaled down their apprentice program. They went down to just a few hundred. And that was because of the recession. And they realized, you know, work was not there. They couldn't run the program the same. She said this time, though, even though we got hit hard economically, she's like, the program was still humming and they were trying to get people in. They were even trying to fill slots. They had, wow, you know, hundreds of people still doing the Carpentry Apprentice Program and different parts of the Carpentry Apprentice Program, because she knew that there were demand for those trades right now, that they want people. So even with the recession that's happening now, they never scaled their program down. That's why they were, you know, they were excited to have us and talk to us about that, because they feel like the work is out there.
That's great. And this doesn't require you to go back to school for 4 years or anything. We're talking about a matter of months, right?
We're talking about a matter of months. It obviously depends on the field. I mean, carpentry apprenticeship, if you're going to become a welder, you do need some levels of certification. Takes a little bit of time, but it's not 4 years. The information technology program that we profiled, we saw programs that start at 2 weeks, you know, maybe go a month, maybe go 3 months, 6 months, up to a year. And then, you know, it's clear, like, even among the hospitals, they're hiring for medical and non-medical positions. So for those non-medical positions, apparently, like, onboarding might be a matter of months, maybe less than a year. So yes, it's not as time consuming as a 4-year degree. Now, I'm not going to lie, it's time consuming. Yeah, you have to devote time and effort to getting into the programs and making sure it works, but it's certainly not as long as, you know, a 4-year degree.
And one more thing, I've read that there is sometimes reluctance based on gender. In other words, there are men who just don't want to get into the available jobs because they were traditionally handled by women, and vice, like healthcare jobs, for example, and vice versa, with women saying, I'll never be accepted as a welder. Do you address that?
You know, we talked to the woman at the Carpentry Apprentice Program. It's a woman who runs it. And she says, I want more women. I want more minorities. I want more people coming into this program from different backgrounds so that we can get them involved, because she said that anybody can do the jobs. She didn't have any qualms about making her pitch to people, like you said, who may not necessarily think, oh, that job is traditionally dominated by this type of person. She's like, no, you know, come in. You can be a part of this. I mean, the information technology, it's a field that, you know, the stereotype is, you know, dominated by men. But the woman we spoke to at the call center is a mom. She has a kid. She was transitioning out of that work, and she was able to find a job pretty quick. And she even admitted to us, she's like, you know, coder is not exactly something you would have seen me and said, oh, she's a coder. I mean, we can obviously buy into stereotypes. Maybe some of them ring true. But, you know, she made it through the program pretty fast. And I think that it's clear, even in healthcare, that they're trying to break down sort of the stereotypes and, you know, the norms as to who can take those jobs. I mean, the woman we spoke to at the University of Washington Medicine Recruiting Office, she said, you know, I'm trying to make my pitches out here right now, trying to tell people, you know, you don't have to have a medical background completely. We can help you get acclimated to certain positions. He's like, if you're in retail, you have skills that we might be able to apply here at the hospital or within the hospital system, and that they'd love to have them.
Ranji Sinha from Cairo 7 with the basic message that the jobs are out there and so is the training if you haven't got the skills. Ranji, thank you.
No problem. Thank you.
Seattle's Morning News, this is Dave Ross, and now the case of Kraken versus Kraken. Mark Walters, you're an attorney, and you are representing a dive bar whose name is what exactly?
It's called the Kraken Bar and Lounge.
The Kraken Bar and Lounge. And it's been running for how long now?
They opened their doors New Year's Eve 2011.
Okay, so this is an established business. We're going close, talking about, 10 years now. And it just happens to have the same name as the facility being run at Northgate by the new hockey team, the Kraken?
Well, yeah, they announced, I think, earlier in April, they announced that they would open a restaurant that's attached to their $80 million practice facility under the name the Kraken Bar and Grill. Mm-hmm. Now, since the lawsuit has been filed, they've announced that they'll change the name.
To what?
Well, we don't know yet, and that's kind of part of some of the open questions.
Yeah. Now, what is it you are demanding that they do? Is changing the name enough?
Of the bar, that's a really good start. You know, we're not asking them to change the name of the hockey team. Mm-hmm. You know, that's sort of already been done. That ship has sailed, so to speak, with the amount of money and marketing that has gone into that name. And, you know, the community's association with that name, it would be very difficult, I think, at this point in time for them to change the name of the hockey team. What we're mostly concerned about are all the ancillary businesses that are connected to the hockey team, bar, restaurant services, live entertainment services that they advertise under the name The Kraken at Climate Pledge Arena. There are certainly punk and metal fans that are also hockey fans, and it's not like we don't want hockey fans at the bar. It's just that we don't want the brand to be continued to be diluted or, you know, diminished in its value. So, you know, before they announced the name of the restaurant, we were getting people calling asking, hey, you know, where can we get season tickets? And we had some people who wanted to make the bar sort of a hockey bar. And that's certainly not what we want to make the bar. The bar is a dive bar. It's themed around punk and metal music. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the bands that play there want to keep it that way. A lot of the patrons want to keep it that way. But it's not like we're anti-hockey or anything.
Right. Boolean logic tells you there are going to be a certain number of hockey fans who are also punk fans. But it sounds like it's not a comfortable fit.
No, that's right. I mean, and then the confusion is a real problem. And prior to their announcement, if you Googled the Kraken or the Kraken Seattle, we were the first search result to come up. And now that's just not the case. And what we're looking for is some solution that would eliminate the confusion or reduce it to some manageable level. A lot of that takes resources to correctively advertise. And so that's one of the parts of the relief that we're asking for in the complaint.
So you're not asking, I mean, you've told me that the Kraken ship has sailed in terms of the name of the team, but that's really what you're up against here, right? I mean, that there's no way a dive bar can market the way an NHL team can.
Well, that's true. And, you know, the brand for the bar will never be the same. And it's unfortunate that there wasn't some sort of dialogue prior to the announcement of the name by the team, so that something could have been worked out. But we are where we are. And I mean, there are a lot of fans that are very much attached to that name, hockey fans. And, you know, trademark law is a lot about what's fair. And, you know, you've got to think about the interests of the fans. You got to think about the interests of the patrons of the bar and come up with some sort of solution that everybody can live with.
So what I'm thinking is, since you're not going to ask them to change the name of the team, about all they could do would be what? To come up with some form of compensatory ongoing payment for having required you to change your marketing or up your marketing?
You know, I don't know. That's all on the table, I guess. We don't know exactly what they're going to change the name of their bar to at the practice facility, but it's attached to the practice facility. I mean, it's hard to imagine that people won't call that the Kraken Bar.
Right.
I think the first item is to do things and to come up with some sort of agreement where we can reduce the confusion. And then second is some form of compensation that would help the bar to maintain its brand identity or just rebrand. I mean, there's you know, they basically will have to start from scratch if they pick a new name. I mean, they've been operating for 10 years. Anybody who's started a bar or a restaurant knows that as soon as you open the door under a new name, I mean, you've got a lot of tough sledding to do because people trust names when they come associated with bars and restaurants. So if they have to pick a new name, that's going to be very costly for them to get to where they are right now under that name.
Have you ever had a case like this before?
You know, a few over the years.
And what happened in those previous cases?
Well, you know, it's a pretty settled area of the law. If you use a name first, you are entitled to that name. So in all of the cases I've had like this, you know, whoever's used it prior tends to have the better legal position.
So you're pretty sure you'll win this. It's just a case of what the team is going to have to do to make this work.
Well, I'm very confident in the merits of our case. Let's just put it that way.
Very good. Mark Walters, the attorney for Kraken Bar and Lounge. Thanks very much for coming on, Mark.
You bet, Dave. Thank you.
Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien, and Anna Scott's joining us. Lawyers for Kids Before Police Can Talk to Them, extending the amount of time you have to renew your driver's license, and making the marijuana industry more equitable, plus the capital gains tax. Let's go to Hannah Scott for the latest on all of the governor's bill signings. Hannah?
And this is a sample, good morning, Dave, of some of the bill signings that the governor did yesterday and a preview of some that he will do today. He did probably a couple of dozen yesterday, but some of the big ones that were getting some attention this session include the one that has to do with lawyers for kids who are interacting with the police. Now, this is named after Machance Gittens. We talked about him a couple of years ago. He was I believe, 17-year-old who was killed by a King County Sheriff's sting that went bad down in Des Moines, I believe. And it was basically he and a friend were going out to deliver alcohol that they had somehow gotten a hold of that they were selling online, and the cops were involved in the sting. They thought his friend was someone that he wasn't, and the kids came out, and then the cops kind of burst out of the back of the van with the guns drawn, and everybody panicked. The kids ran, and they ended up getting shot because the deputy said they had guns. I don't know that that's ever been proven. There was a big lawsuit that was recently settled. This is named after him. King County had first passed it. Basically, what it says is you cannot talk to the kid. You can't allow a juvenile to waive their right to counsel before they are offered that right to counsel. And you can't allow them to waive their rights to say that they'll talk to police after Miranda rights without having first had the opportunity to talk to a lawyer, is essentially what this does. Because they were getting tricked to some degree. And I think the argument is that they get scared, especially when you're talking about kids in the Black community. They're already on edge because of dealings with police. And that was the idea. And it got passed, and the governor signed that yesterday. So now they will all always have to have access to a lawyer before they're allowed to say, hey, I go ahead and waive my rights, police. You can take my statement or whatever it might be.
Okay.
And questions?
Oh, I thought you were going to play Melanie Morgan.
No, that's pot. So I'm moving on.
Oh, okay.
So another big issue for this legislative session was equity, with one of the main focuses, of course, social equity in the cannabis industry. Democratic State Representative Melly Morgan says after years of the war on drugs that disproportionately impacted Black people, it's time they get to benefit from the legal industry, because what had happened for years was
we are going to arrest certain individuals for the drug when it was a drug and illegal, but now we have made it legal. And so the very people who were marginalized with this drug that it's made legal now needs to be made whole.
Here's the idea.
What we want to do is first make the Black African American community whole and balanced with its white counterparts, and then opening it up to equity across the state of Washington to all communities of color and all marginalized individuals.
So basically this work started, and I think you and I have talked about this before, it started the previous session. They created this task force that was supposed to look at ways how they can, I think she said there's one Black-owned marijuana, legal marijuana shop in Seattle, one in Spanaway, which is where she represents, and really not very many throughout the whole state. So that's the idea, is to try to more equitably put these licenses out.
I thought part of the problem was you needed investment capital to start a store, and Black people tend not to have that.
And that is absolutely true. So there's a Department of Commerce is supposed to contract to establish kind of a list of mentors who will help these people, and then they're going to repurpose some licenses. So people, I think existing marijuana shops that lose their license for whatever reason, or if more become available, then they have to go first to the Black community. And it's not all other communities of color. This is very specific to the Black community.
Now, how do you determine that? This is the other question. How do you determine that?
They have various, it's a task force. So that's what I was going to start to say. They have this whole task force that's created, which is with you got members of the LCB there who are focusing on this work.
You allowed to say that, we have these licenses we have for whatever reason. We are only Black people need apply. I don't think you're allowed to do that, are you?
And that's the idea, is to level that. But I don't know that it specifically says it that way. And I don't know that they've come up with the exact process for that. I think that's what the task force is for at this point. But the overarching goal is, because the Black community were the ones who were very disproportionately locked up under the war on drugs for marijuana for extensive decades, right? Decades at a time. Right. I think just a couple of years ago,
I can see where you would find the people who were arrested for pot violations, and I suppose give them preference, because that's clear. And it doesn't necessarily depend just on race, right? This is somebody who was arrested under a law that has since been changed, and now we consider what was once illegal to be a legitimate business. And since we threw you in jail all those years, you couldn't earn a living, yes, now we're going to give you a preference. I guess I could see doing it that way.
Possibly. And I don't know that it's specific to those who were necessarily locked up. I think it's the Black community as a whole, again, because of that over because of what you're talking about people getting locked up. But it's, I don't know that it goes direct to that person who was locked up. Again, this is a task force. They'll report to, they expanded their scope with the bill that was passed this session. And I think the report is due December of next year. So this is a long process. There's a lot of work. There's some law enforcement concerns and equity concerns on the flip side, right? Like you're talking about. So still a lot to be worked out, but they were excited that they made the progress that they did, including this mentoring part of it, which is, when those licenses do go to those people who maybe don't have as much entrepreneur experience or they don't know necessarily how to run this business, they'll get some help from those who have been in the industry for a while. So that's a good one.
Okay.
Then also we have the extension. How long do you have to get your license renewed in this state? 6 years usually, right? And I think Sully talked about this before. Well, because the pandemic has really, really messed up the State Department of Licensing, they are going to extend it to 8 years now. You can do your license renewal every 8 years. And Democratic Representative Alex Rammel explains why this was important.
So COVID-19 has really impacted Department of Licensing's ability to serve customers. Before the pandemic, they were providing in-person service for about 70% of the services provided. And they're now operating at about 35% capacity because of social distancing requirements. And what that's meant is a backlog. It's hard for our constituents to get appointments.
And not just a backlog for IDs and driver's licenses.
We need IDs for everything from jobs to housing, medication, and other essential items. I'm sure many of you have heard from your constituents about these challenges. And unfortunately, this isn't a problem that's just going to go away once folks have all been vaccinated. The backlog is big enough that Department of Licensing is anticipating that it could extend for years.
So they can, for years, right, the backlog to get all of those IDs done. Plus, we have the enhanced driver's license deadline coming up, so it's going to be a mess. So that's why they're going to let this go for 8 years. The governor signed all of those I just talked to you about yesterday, so those are in effect at various different times. The ones he will sign today, the capital gains tax.
Ah. All right. That's and we'll be discussing that extensively, I'm sure.
Yes, you bet.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Time for your Daily Dose of Kindness now, brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. We've got a local Daily of Dose of Kindness for you today from our news partners, Cairo 7 TV. In Bellevue, a man was enjoying dinner at the Pump House Bar & Grill when a stranger interrupted his meal. Her reason for the intrusion? She wanted to save his life. Lindsay Sheldon has the story.
Do you ever think about, do you have a specific purpose in your life? That moment, it was perfectly timed.
That moment at the Pump House in Bellevue this March. Katie Bickle knows it could have easily not happened at all.
I will probably remember this every single time I come here.
One of Katie's friends left early, so Katie changed seats. Only then did she notice a man across the room.
Rubbing his wrist and then would kind of go wipe his forehead. And his color was awful.
Katie's a nurse who works with people with heart problems. She tells us he wasn't grabbing his chest or doubling over, but
I was pretty certain he was having a heart attack.
And stranger or no stranger, she couldn't just sit back and watch. After a few more minutes, she walked over to his table with a mask on.
Sat down next to him, actually.
She explained she was a nurse, put her hand on his back, and found he was sweating a lot.
Inside, I'm like, this is very wrong, and he needs to go to the emergency room ASAP.
This is that man, David Toe. He had finished karate practice about an hour before.
Did you ever think in those moments this could be a heart attack?
No, never.
He'd even thought about going home instead of meeting his friends at the restaurant. A move that could have been a death sentence.
What did it feel like for you?
Just a bad asthma attack.
I said, I don't think this is asthma, but you look very uncomfortable, and I'm really concerned.
David's friends agreed to take him around the corner to her workplace, Overlake Medical Center. When a blood clot formed, it prevented blood flow to the entire front wall of the heart.
You have about 4 to 6 hours from when it closes to get it open.
Cardiologist Thomas Amidon says that means Katie was crucial. Dr. Amidon operated on David, inflating a balloon and embedding a stent into the artery's walls. It restored blood flow quickly.
I'm so glad to see you.
And it's why we were able to reunite David and Katie at the hospital.
Can I give you a hug?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm so glad to see you.
Thank you.
I'm probably more emotional than you, but I'm just so glad to see you, and you look so good.
This was their first time sitting down to talk about the experience.
You see my savior. Even if Katie came over after an hour, It would have been worse. I might have collapsed.
Dr. Amidon says heart attacks aren't usually sharp, stabbing pain like you see in the movies. Instead, it's
burning, tightness, pressure, heaviness, oftentimes confused with heartburn and acid reflux.
And he says if these symptoms are severe, abrupt, or following exercise instead of eating, think about your heart.
Is there the possibility for you to have heart disease and really never know it until you have a moment like this?
Yes.
Dr. Amidon says heart disease is the country's leading cause of death for women and men. And David knows without this chance encounter, he could have been one of them.
I was kind of express how grateful I am to you for being there that day at that specific time.
It just makes me so thankful.
Me too.
That is Cairo 7 TV's Lindsay Sheldon with that amazing story.
It is an amazing story. Direct from the G and Ursula show, which starts at 9 a.m. right here on Cairo Radio. Here is G Scott. I admit, I was surprised about the announcement that Bill and Melinda were splitting up. I'm sorry to hear that. But, I mean, their kids are grown. So, I don't know. What do you think's going on?
I think that they've had a great marriage, 27 years, right? And like you said, their kids are grown. I think one of their last ones is getting ready to head off to college. And so when you have situations like that, I mean, you know, there's that success in there. You know, I had a buddy of mine say, well, wow, they got problems. Well, if someone's married for 27 years or they're married for 30 years, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have problems. It could be amicable, right? Like it could be a say, hey, you know what? Let's go ahead and do something else, right? And so that happens. So I think that there is this misconception that if people don't die together, that it wasn't a successful relationship. And I said, and that's a possibility here. Now, in this case, I think what happens is that when we see something like this, when we see the Bezos split up, and when we see the Gates split up, and we see relationships of people who have every financial resource in the world, it makes us kind of look at ourselves like, wow, well, if they're getting divorced, what's going to happen to me? You see, guys, I have no excuse. I've been married so many times that, you know.
How many times? You always say that, and you make it sound like a lot, but how many times?
More than once. So there you go, Colleen. More than once is a
and
lot
for me.
How
long did your successful marriages last?
You know, I hit up one for almost 7 years. Hit up one for about a year.
When you call marriage hitting somebody up, yeah, I think maybe that.
I didn't say hit them up. I say I hit up the marriage.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I get it. Yeah, I agree with you on the assessment of the marriage. I was talking with Miley, our news editor, about this morning. I said 27 years is a success. Like, you don't have to call something failure just because it ends in divorce. Like, they raised three great children, and they've made an amazing empire and charitable foundation and changed the world. So let them live their lives how they want.
Yeah. There has to be some legalities here, though, too. It may be that she just wants to strike out on her own the way Mackenzie Bezos has done in terms of her charitable mission. I mean, that's
well, Mackenzie divorced Jeff Bezos because he had a mistress.
There was that too. Yes.
Yeah. hey, Colleen. Very good point. The same. But I want to say this because you know you're going to see it, and I've actually seen it already. Can we please stop with the now Bill's got to go ahead and pay her and give her half? Hold up, Melinda. She been there from the very beginning.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? She helped build the empire that they have together as a couple. We have to stop with this notion of, like, this idea that she was just, oh, honey, how was your day? Yo, Melinda Gates was doing her thing, too. So we didn't stop with that.
Yeah. Well, I feel bad mentioning because, you know, Bill Gates has not been a publicity hound, nor has his wife. This is, you know, it's not like we're watching... what's their names? Kate and whoever.
Oh, the Kardashians.
Know more about than I do.
The Kardashians?
Well whoever. anybody whose marriage is all over YouTube
Kate Middleton?
And Institute.
Oh, Kate Middleton?
Yeah, that one.
Oh,
that's the royal stuff. But Harry and Meghan are going strong.
Right.
They
Harry
divorced
Meghan,
the royal family.
Yeah. Hey, Colleen, you know what I hear right now? Hold up. Let's get a pause here.
What?
Dave, don't act like you don't like some of this gossip news that happens in the world.
I truly don't believe he does, knowing Dave as long as I have, he really does not.
I bet you spend your Sundays watching on DVR Real Housewives of Atlanta, New Jersey, Orange County, Vanderpump Rules.
Do you know how many times, G, I have tried to get Dave interested in gossip? He has zero interest. It's just zero.
Why, Dave?
Because it doesn't affect me. It's somebody's personal life. Don't you hate it when other people know something about you that you didn't want them to know? I mean, now for people who are out there actively seeking the publicity, and again, I say Bill Gates and his wife have not, then that's one thing. They've got publicity agents which are planting the negative stories because they benefit by having them out there. But the Gates haven't done that.
No, they have not, you know, and I think the Gates, when we start talking about like what we like as far as gossip, I'll admit, I think the Gates for me is kind of off limits because I think they're different, you know, than the Kardashians and everybody else. Yeah, I'm all up in y'all business.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about that with Ursula, won't we, G?
Are you trying to say that our show does a lot of talking about these types of things?
9 o'clock.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
And this is Seattle's Morning News. Every Tuesday, David Farenthold joins us live from the Washington Post. And let's see, get me caught up on what I missed while I was on vacation last week. The FBI raided Rudy Giuliani's home. Do we know what they were looking for?
It seems to have been in relation to Giuliani's work with folks in Ukraine who were trying to influence U.S. policy to help Russia. So, I think Giuliani's being investigated as basically acting as an unregistered foreign agent.
Okay, but I mean, you're allowed to be a foreign agent, you just have to register. So this is pretty much a clerical matter then?
Well, he didn't register, but if you don't register, it's a big deal. This is something that the government has been cracking down more on lately to people who have not registered as foreign agents. And I think in Giuliani's case, it appears to be, I think also that they took a... So the feds took a cell phone from another lawyer who was working with Giuliani. So this seems to have been pretty long running contact to help Ukraine and Russia's allies in Ukraine while Trump was president. Mm.
Now, is this something that the tweets I've gotten on this allege that Rudy's being framed? There's really nothing to see here. I mean, where do you come down on that?
Well, so this investigation began under Trump's DOJ. Apparently, Trump's DOJ leaders didn't allow the raid to happen while they were in charge. But obviously, this is something that began under Donald Trump's administration. So you'd think if there was anybody who was not interested in framing Rudy Giuliani, it would be the Trump administration.
Yeah.
And the fact of this, I'm no expert on this from what I've read, the fact of this raid means that the FBI has gone to a judge and presented with this compelling evidence that a crime was committed, and that evidence of this crime would be at Giuliani's apartment. So they've passed a legal hurdle. They've gotten the approval from a judge for a search warrant, although obviously they haven't filed charges against Giuliani yet.
Yeah. It just seems to me after, you know, being framed by Sacha Baron Cohen, this is just piling on. But
well, it's sort of an ironic thing that I think if it had gone further while Trump was in charge and they'd raided Rudy Giuliani in December, he would have gotten pardoned. But because the Trump people kept it bottled up and waited until after Trump left office, Rudy is unpardoned.
Okay. Something having to do with your paper. I've received emails from listeners, and I apologize, I'm not really certain of the source, but they insist that your newspaper has stopped fact-checking Joe Biden. They are not seeing fact checks of they're not seeing you pay attention as much attention to the missteps of Joe Biden as you did to Donald Trump. Is it true?
No, we are fact checking Joe Biden. They wrote the fact checker for the Post wrote a whole column about Joe Biden's fact checks before his Biden's sort of State of the Union esque speech last week. The problem is that Biden doesn't lie as much as Trump does. Biden, you know, he has some exaggerations. He has some half truths. He's a more typical politician in that way, and that usually what he says is some grounding in reality. Trump was unusual. I mean, we fact checked them both, but you know, there were a lot less facts to catch under Trump, a lot more lies to write about. So we're continuing to cover him. It's just the coverage is different because the people are different.
Yeah. So the key to getting more fact checks on Biden is just to somehow get him to lie a little more.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we are checking everything Biden says, but if there's no lies, you know, then there's not much to check. The difference between there's a lot of differences between Biden and Trump, one being that Biden doesn't lie all the time, but Biden also doesn't speak all the time. He doesn't have a Twitter account. He doesn't give off the cuff press conferences.
That is what a huge difference. I have so many more hours in my day now since that began not happening.
And that was Biden's promise. He said you weren't going to have to worry about him. We're going to have to think about him all the time. And I think he's followed through on that.
Yeah. One thing I also noticed, and which seemed to be trending this morning, is that Republicans are opposing Biden's portions of his American Reconstruction Plan, whatever they're calling it now. But I also understand that they are taking credit for parts of it. So I'm trying to figure out how deep this Republican divide really is. I understand that on Twitter and on social media, they have to protest everything Biden tries to do. That's the way the game is played. But I mean, if you get down to the actual specifics of the types of things this would fund, is there in fact Republican support for it?
Well, if you look at the polls, there is broad support for the things Biden is planning to do with or asking to do with this infrastructure plan. And there's lots of support from Republican mayors and governors, things like that, people who are not in Congress. And the Biden administration's pitch is like, look, when we said bipartisan, we didn't mean, you know, we need some number of senators and congressmen. We're talking about people out in the country. You know, people, if Republicans out in the country support this, it's bipartisan, no matter what the Republicans in Congress say. I think Biden has been pretty smart about that. Taking his cue from Trump, right? Trump broke the Republican consensus about spending, which has been the attacks on Obama during the Tea Party, which is he was spending too much. Trump spent money like water, and Republicans loved it. And so I think Biden, in that way, is following a path that Trump has laid open to show that if you just spend a hell of a lot of money, people are going to like you better. And I think there's less Republican antagonism toward that because of what Trump did.
Do you think it's time to bring back earmarks? Remember, earmarks were individual members of Congress, I guess mostly senators, were basically given a pot of money, and they could devote them to local projects, typically highway projects or light rail projects. And it was a way of getting more bipartisanship, because Republicans would get just as much money as Democrats would for these local projects. And I know that we threw that out long ago because it was considered to be pork barrel spending. But these were all projects that local people wanted. So what would be wrong with doing that again?
Well, I don't think anything if you policed it, right? I mean, I think the problem with earmarks was that they became abused so that, you know, just to pick one example, there was a Democratic congressman, John Murtha, in Western Pennsylvania. All kinds of crazy federal programs were located in that district, in Johnstown, PA, because he happened to be powerful and on the Appropriations Committee. So that it led to a lot of wasteful spending. But you're right. There was a whole consensus built in Washington, like a functioning, you know, a way the Congress functioned because there were these earmarks. And so you could give people you know, something they could take back home to their district. And like, there's a huge tradition of Republicans in southern states running on that. I brought money back home to Mississippi. I brought money back home to Alabama. And when you get rid of that, what they've been running on is just pure ideology. Then you get somebody like Tommy Tuberville from Alabama who's just like, you know, I hate Biden, I hate liberals. You know, if you brought earmarks back and you got back to that situation, Washington might be a more cooperative place. That said, you'd have to do it in a way that meant that people didn't abuse it.
Yeah. I was looking at the census results, and apparently your home state, Texas, the big winner. You're going to get a couple more congressional seats, and people are moving there in droves. The presumption seems to be, though, that they are all the new residents are Republicans. Are they?
No, I don't think so. I think if you look at the bigger problem for Democrats is that there are lots of folks who are moving there to the big cities who are Democrats, but they're cramming themselves all together. in sort of vote sinks in the cities, and they're not changing the dynamics of the suburbs of the exurbs. So Texas has done a huge job bringing in people from all over the country. But the Democrats haven't been able to capitalize, A, because they're just incompetent in Texas, and B, because their folks tend to be clustered together and their votes don't count as much.
Well, taking it out of politics, though, just to the economic policies that make people and businesses want to locate there, they've got no income tax, same as us, right?
Mm-hmm. No income tax.
Okay, so if they have no income tax and we have no income tax and Texas is doing better than we are at luring people in, what else are they doing that we're not doing?
Well, I think that Texas has sold itself as like super low regulation. You know, it's easy to start a business there. It's easy to, you know, Houston doesn't have any zoning. If you could build whatever you want, they've kind of cast themselves as the anti-California. You know, we're warm. Yeah. You can come to us for our good climate, but you know, we're not going to tax.
Does it work? Are people happy there?
I mean, people do seem to be happy. It is really hot, but other than that, I think
zoning can't fix that. But I mean, there's always this fear that if you get rid of zoning, then suddenly you're living next to a coal-fired power plant, you know?
That's Houston, man. that's my hometown. You can literally build whatever you want and nobody cares. So I think that has really attracted a ton of people to Texas, right. And it's been very successful in that way. We'll see if it's sustainable.
Really? So you can add a porch onto your house without worrying about impervious surfaces swamps and some kind of damage to the local crow population? I mean,
as I understand it, you could add a 10-story building onto your house. Nobody cares.
Okay.
It's just whatever you do in your house is your castle. That's how Houston's chosen to do it.
Yeah, got it. David Farenthal from The Washington Post. Thank you, David.
Thank you. You can ring my bell.
Ring the bell. Wheels of Hollywood grind very slowly. Car Radio's Rachel Bell introduces us to a local filmmaker who went outside the system to make sure that his original vision made it all the way to the screen.
One, two.
After 10 years of blood, sweat, and tears, a Seattle writer and director is finally releasing his first film nationwide this Friday.
Dad.
Yeah, buddy.
Do you know any kung fu?
The Paper Tigers is a kung fu action comedy about three kids who studied martial arts together, lost touch, and then reunited as 40-year-old men.
And they find out their master is killed, and they have to come back together and find out what happened. They're out of shape. They've got kids. They got jobs. And ultimately, they have to avenge their master. So the way we like to say it is, imagine if you had to fight a death match tonight, but you have to go pick up your kid from soccer beforehand.
That's filmmaker Bao Tran. Several years ago, Bao shopped the script around Hollywood, the traditional route of getting a film made. But in every single meeting, he heard the same thing. We'll make your film if you swap out the Asian and African-American actors with white actors.
It was just insane. Like, we would just get crazy notes in terms of making the film. Like, well, just get Bruce Willis and put him in the movie and you can make this movie. First of all, duh. Second of all, did you read the script? So I think there's a lot of old thinking that hasn't died out completely yet.
And since there is such a long tradition of whitewashing films, the executives don't seem to have any problem being blunt about what they want.
It's definitely couched in kind of business sense, so it doesn't feel prejudiced, but it is, obviously. Keep in mind, this was before, you know, Crazy Rich Asians or Black Panther, before we could really point to all these big movies. But they'll say, there's no successful film with leading cast of color. How can you re-justify this to put our money in and make a movie like this? So it's kind of that catch-22 and that never-ending cycle. So, there is a brazenness because they kind of feel like they have history and data by their side. Fortunately, those dinosaurs are dying out, and that's just an old way of thinking. It is just so patently absurd, and yet it is a very, very prevalent way of thinking.
Bao refused to recast the film, so he came back to Seattle and set up a Kickstarter. On the crowdfunding page, he wrote, "We've had offers to fully fund the film if only we change our main characters to Caucasians. We've had offers to fully fund the film if we shoot in China. We've had offers to sell the script and shop it to a more famous director. But this is a distinctly Asian and American story, and we have consistently stuck to our guns to make the movie we want to make." In the end, the film was fully funded by the community and local investors. Seattle's Yuji Okamoto is a producer on The Paper Tigers. Yuji played Chosen Toguchi in Karate Kid Part 2 and in Cobra Kai.
You know, we've seen this before with Joy Luck Club. As an actor, we thought, oh, this is the turnaround film. This is what's going to help us get over the hump, and there's going to be more roles created for us. But that never happened. And I think we kind of missed the boat on that. We didn't capitalize on it as a collective. So I think this time around, I think we're more prepared. You know, when Crazy Rich came out, and now we have so many other films that are coming out and so many television shows that maybe this is the time. So I think for Asian Americans now, we have to step up and support these films and shows.
The Paper Tigers was shot in Seattle before the pandemic shutdown, with a lot of the scenes set in the Chinatown International District. The film opens nationwide this Friday in both theaters and online on platforms like Amazon and Google Play. But if you want a sneak peek, there is a showing at Bellevue's Lincoln Square on Thursday. Go to mynorthwest.com/Rachel Bell, that's B-E-L-L-E, to learn more.
It is hard to believe that somebody would actually sit across the table from this guy who's doing a film about Asian Americans and say, well, you can do your film about Asian Americans, but you've got to cast white people in those roles.
I mean, is anything hard to believe anymore? We're hearing so much. We're uncovering so much.
It was a few years ago, though, right? I mean, that he first
still
came up with the concept.
A few years ago, you'd think we were more advanced, but I'm glad that we are pulling back the curtain on all of this.
Yeah. So, pretty good story, huh? I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.